Next up is McGill and Dearden.
Your Honor, Kathleen Garvin, petitioner in the Supreme Court. I believe I should go first.
Someone filed a notice of appeal in the Court of Appeals. They're the appellant, and they go first.
Thank you. That would be me, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Mary Lee Erickson. I'm here on behalf of Mr. McGill, the appellant in the original appeal. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
I'll get this. We're getting there. There we go.
Thank you, Your Honor.
It's so good.
We're here today to ask this Court to stand by its decision in the April 2016 Bearden versus McGill case, in which the court reversed the trial court and held that in determining whether a party has improved its position on a trial de novo, the court applies a comparing comparables, and the comparables compared are the category of relief requested at the arbitration with the same category of relief requested at trial.
How do you square your position with the remand that directs us to look at Nelson versus Erickson?
My position, Your Honor, is that Nelson versus Erickson is silent with regard to the comparing comparable test.
Well, that may be, but we have direction from the Supreme Court to look at that case. So what's your position on what we should look at in that case?
I think the court should look at the case and say, this is what the Supreme Court decided in Nelson. And my understanding of Nelson, and it was a case in which I was counsel, the court was looking at the question of improving one's position on trial de novo, but not in the context of an arbitration award and a trial result. It dealt with a specific statute, the offer of compromise statute, and the case law interpreting that, which was the Nickham versus Enquist case. And that's a specific statute, as the court's very familiar with. It says the offer of compromise amount determines or substitutes for the arbitration award.
Aren't we being naive to think that the Supreme Court doesn't think there's some message in Nelson versus Erickson for us, or they would have just left our case alone?
Well, perhaps. Perhaps that is a naive response. And the best that I have been able to decipher, as I know this court needs to decipher why it was that the Supreme Court said, asked this court to re-look at the Bearden case, is that the Nelson case did adopt the rule of applying an ordinary meaning to the question of whether what an offer of compromise means. And to the extent that that's a rule that came out of the Nelson case, and that would apply to the Bearden case, I don't think it changes the result here.
Should we look at the circumstance that in Nelson the court looked at the jury verdict rather than the judgment for the result in the Superior Court trial de novo?
That is one option that the court has, and as the court might recall when we were here originally, almost a year ago today, January 14, 2016, I argued that Mr. McGill had prevailed in the trial de novo because you just look at the damages award from the arbitration and the damages award from the jury trial. And under that comparison,
so that would have been $44,000 versus $42,500.
Correct, Your Honor.
And even if we added in the costs awarded by the arbitrator, your client still would have improved his position if we compare that award to the jury verdict.
I haven't actually done the math, but I'll take Your Honor's word for it.
Total costs are less than $2,000.
Yes, then indeed. So here's why.
Maybe you ought to embrace the Erickson case.
Well, I have embraced the Erickson case, and I believe the Erickson case stands on its own. And to the extent that the Supreme Court, in asking this court to reconsider the Bearden case, is saying, we haven't really commented, Supreme Court says, we haven't really commented on the comparing comparables, but what we want the court to do is look at the...
Well, they did comment on it in Nickham, though.
They did, but they didn't...
And not favorably.
But they didn't directly say it wasn't adopted, and they didn't directly adopt it. So we're left in this questionable situation. There are two ways this court can affirm its decision. It can stay with the decision it issued and look at the Supreme Court's granting of the petition and sending back for reconsideration as a simple, this case involves mandatory arbitration, attorney's fees. Look at the Nelson case. Or, alternatively, this court can affirm the result by concluding Mr. McGill improved his position, because when you compare the award of arbitration with the award at the Superior Court, then he did better. He had to pay less to Mr. Bearden. The challenge becomes, because Nelson dealt with the offer of compromise, we don't have a breakdown of costs from the arbitration. We just have the offer of compromise amount. And the Nelson holding, as I understand it, is the offer of compromise amount is whatever you say it is, and we're going to construe any ambiguities against the person making the offer. And so we would ask the court to affirm its decision as before, and if the court feels it compelled to alter its decision in light of the Supreme Court's remand, that the court rule in favor of Mr. McGill again based on him improving, comparing the arbitration award to the jury's award to Mr. Bearden.
And do you mean without costs?
Yes, without costs. If that's what this court believes is the reason that the Supreme Court took the petition and remanded it for consideration.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kathleen Garvin on behalf of James Bearden, petitioner in the Supreme Court, respondent in this court. I was going to ask to reserve 4 minutes, but since I'm in this position. Your Honors, by granting review to Mr. Bearden with his petition and remanding this case for reconsideration in light of the Nelson case, the Supreme Court is clearly directing that the unique phrase fails to improve a party's position, which is found in MAR 7.3, and it's also found in the offer of compromise statute, RCW 706050, and the corollary to MAR 7.3, 7.06.060. All three of those statutes use that same phrase, and the Supreme Court clearly directs that phrase is to be interpreted to mean as an ordinary, read the statute, the issue as an ordinary person would.
Hey, you've asked us to compare the arbitration award to the trial court's judgment following the trial de novo. Is there any state Supreme Court case addressing this comparison issue where the Supreme Court has looked to the judgment in the trial court as opposed to the jury verdict?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
In both Nickham?
Depending on what the parties were asking for,
well,
I believe.
In both Nelson and Nickham, the Supreme Court doesn't discuss at all what costs were recoverable following verdict. It only looks to the verdict. Why should we do anything different?
Well, Your Honor, I think you should take into account the rule on MAR 7.3, 6.4 was changed in 2011.
To allow the arbitrator
to specifically award costs and tell the parties they needed to. So before that time, arbitrators often didn't award costs, so you didn't have a damages
Nelson
plus cost.
Nelson is a post-amendment rule.
I understand. And in Nelson, I suggest what happened to you is the offer of compromise made a reference to costs, specific costs, made an arbitration that I believe Nelson wanted to deduct. It wasn't my case. I'm not as familiar with the facts. I only know what's in the record. They wanted to deduct the arbitration costs from their offer of compromise. The verdict came in, and there is no discussion in any of the appeal that there were any costs asked for, awarded, but they certainly weren't asked for by the plaintiff in that case, who was asking to deduct costs, not to add costs.
Well, but the plaintiff or the defendant could have made and maybe did make the argument about no more costs. We don't know anything about costs because the court seems to go to great lengths to telling us costs aren't something we should be looking at. As soon as the trial de novo request is filed, there's no prevailing party and no entitlement to costs. If you look back at Nickham, Justice Chambers in his dissent goes so far as to say, I'm not suggesting that costs should be considered if the offer of compromise wasn't made. One can read Nickham and Nelson to say, forget about the costs, do something really simple. Compare the compensatory damage award with the arbitrator to the compensatory damage award with the jury. What's wrong with that reading of those two cases?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think the facts are different. Here, the facts are very easy. Damages plus costs at arbitration, damages plus costs at trial. There was nothing new. There was nothing different. Though this is really an easy case. Compare comparables doesn't even apply in this circumstances. Compare comparables was developed by this court when you were trying to figure out how to fairly compare positions when there were different claims. Here there are no different claims. Costs are clearly part of what is authorized by the statute in the awards, and it's part of what furthers the purpose of the mandatory arbitration system. The statutory costs are small.
There's a statute that provides that when a plaintiff wins in a trial de novo, but the defendant wins under the MAR rules, in other words, the defendant did better, that there are certain costs that the plaintiff gets awarded as the prevailing party, even though they're not the prevailing party under the MAR rules. In other words, you still get your $250 statutory attorney fee. Just the fact that the other side gets, that you don't get awarded attorney's fees, reasonable attorney fees, the fact that you're not the prevailing party under the MARs doesn't take away your right. At what do we do this compare? How do we know what the final costs are, giving that statute? That seems to indicate that the decision of who wins, who's the prevailing party under the trial de novo, is made before there's a decision to award a statutory attorney's fee. Else there would be no need for the statute saying even if you're not the prevailing party under the MARs, you still get your costs as the prevailing party because you have a judgment in your favor. Why does that statute exist if we don't do the comparison until after the awards, after the costs have been awarded? That doesn't seem to make sense.
Your Honor, I think it makes perfect sense. That statute is very specific, and costs are very minimal and very predictable. $250 for the statutory attorney's fees, $10 for a witness fee. It's not a lot of money. It's never a lot of money.
Well, several thousand dollars in this case, wasn't it?
Yeah, and by the way, Your Honor, $2,000 of the difference was because of depositions that the defendant's witness, Larry Murphy, wasn't able to come to trial. They picked a witness that wasn't available, so we had a perpetuation debt. Those
but
costs are known. They're established.
Yes,
this was
but why
expensive.
Why does the statute exist? If the statute seems to assume that you already know who's the prevailing party under the MAR rules before you get to awarding the statutory attorney fee?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, it's probably pretty clear who the prevailing party was going to be. And that happens in lots of these MAR cases.
And that's because liability wasn't disputed?
I don't believe it was disputed. Well, but the, I mean. The defendants were appealing on damages.
The question was how much.
Pardon me?
The only real issue at trial was how much money was your client entitled to receive.
Right. So when a defendant appeals, they know they're going to.
Well, what
not
problem was
the plaintiff will
what
be the prevailing party.
What problem was the legislature solving by passing a statute that said even if you're not the prevailing party under the MAR rules, you still get your $250 fee awarded? What purpose can that serve unless it's already known whether you're the prevailing party before the question of whether you get the $250 is addressed by the court?
That would be a case where there maybe liability is contested at an MAR, and if the plaintiff was the prevailing party but didn't improve the other party improved the
position.
You're
missing my point. My point is that the legislature seemed to believe that the determination of who prevailed on the MARs was made prior to the determination of the award of these costs.
You know, the prevailing party gets costs after arbitration. They get costs, and they get additional costs that are incurred with trial. I only have 45 seconds left, so I'd like to make a comment that
okay,
I hope
don't address the matters that concern me. That's your option. That's
well, I want to address
your time, and if I think that there's a statute that might inform us and you don't want to discuss it, you're absolutely free not to discuss
it. Your Honor, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the prevailing party costs is, I think, a simple issue. What I think you need to look at is the goal of the mandatory arbitration system, which is to take these small cases out and to stop clogging the court with these. There's a carrot and stick approach, and awarding costs is a very small part of a factor, and it weighs on one. The non-appealing party needs to look at, when I appeal this, I'm going to spend $100,000 in actual costs to try this case, to have a trial de novo, take the court's time, take all the parties' time, to improve my position by a very small amount. We want to discourage that. And a very small way of doing that is using the known and very predictable 484-010 costs. Thank you.
And you have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And I only gave you 3, so I need to correct that.
To accept the position of Mr. Bearden would require this court, in essence, to overrule the Tran case. And again,
well, the Supreme Court's, I think, not very interested in the Tran case.
They don't seem to be, but they've never really addressed it. And I understand what I sense is the court's frustration with what do we do with this case because the decision in Nelson does not speak to it.
Well, they tell us that we view it as an ordinary person would view it. They just don't tell us what it is.
Exactly. And that's the problem for practitioners. And that's why I have asked this court to affirm as it is or to get to the same result by the comparison of the compensatory damages award. As the Supreme Court did in both Nickham and Nelson, they looked only to here's the offer of compromise amount. We will compare that to the jury's award. In Nelson, it happened to be the jury's award plus additor, but it was the compensatory damage award.
Counsel suggests it's just the posture of the case that causes them only to look at the jury award, because the cost award wouldn't have had any bearing on the issue before the court. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think we know that, Your Honor, because the costs aren't even addressed in the Nelson case, except to the extent it's included as a phrase that was in the offer of compromise. And the Nilkim case was the one where the court deducted the trial statutory costs, and the Supreme Court said you cannot do that. The mandatory arbitration system is indeed set in
looking to costs in Nickham and in Nelson versus Erickson, looking to the costs that the plaintiff would recover post-verdict wouldn't have any impact on the court's analysis or decision, would it?
Well, it did not, and I don't think it does because
both those cases really were how do we parse the offer of compromise? In one case, do we deduct costs because they shouldn't be there when we're comparing? And the other one is, when you say award plus cost, what does that mean? Neither one really provides us much help with what we should look at in a case like this one.
I would agree, Your Honor, that it doesn't, neither of those cases, and that's why my main position is that the court has asked you, the Supreme Court has asked you to relook at your case, but there's nothing in Nelson that really gives direction. The only direction that I could decipher from it is compare the compensatory award to the compensatory, from arbitration to the compensatory award at trial. And there's good reason for having that simple comparison, at least in a case like this. I understand in other cases it may not.
Let me ask you the question I asked. There's a statute that says that if a party gets a judgment in their favor, even if they're the loser under the trial de novo, they still are entitled to the statutory costs, like the filing fee and the statutory attorney's fee. Doesn't that indicate the legislature's belief that those awards are made after a determination is made of who's the winner and who's the loser under the trial de novo statute?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, I think the prevailing party provision for statutory costs, the prevailing party gets that regardless of the outcome.
Well, that's what the law provides. But what I'm saying is why does that statute exist unless the legislature is of the belief that the determination of who was the prevailing party is made before there's a determination, before the judge actually rules on whether or not to award costs? Prevailing party under the trial de novo statute.
Okay, so if I may?
Yeah.
So the prevailing party statute under 484.010, it looks to the outcome of the trial or in the arbitration. That is done first. Then, at the trial level, it is the party who believes that the de novoing party has not improved their position who comes in and asks the Superior Court.
Well, I understand that's how practitioners may be doing it. My question is whether or not that's how the legislature envisioned it being done when they passed the statute. And our time has gone, so we won't be able to discuss this any further. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask the court to affirm.
Next up, Sandhu and Children's Hospital.